Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a candidate for Salt Lake County clerk claimed that the 2020 election was stolen and called Democrats commies and Marxists. Salt Lake City employs a rapid intervention team to try to prevent the establishment of large homeless encampments. The Utah Transit Authority cuts back service. And how a state plan to turn 28,500 acres of land covering Tabby Mountain into a public wildlife and hunting preserve got derailed. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune City and County reporter Blake Apgar. And thanks so much for being here, Blake. Really appreciate it.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Also joining us, Brian Maffley, who is public lands and environment reporter with the Tribune. Welcome to you, Brian.
Yeah, good morning, Roger. Thank you for having me, man.
Glad to have you. And Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle is joining us as well. Good morning, George.
Good morning on this beautiful morning.
It is a beautiful morning. Well, let's start off. I'll remind listeners that you can join this conversation actually by tweeting your questions and comments to @KCPW or by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's start actually with this story that Tribune political correspondent Brian Schott wrote. And George Pyle, I'm going to try and set up his reporting and then just get you to respond as an editorial voice here in the studio. This is a story that he wrote about the Republican candidate for Salt Lake County clerk, Goud Margani. On social media, he accused Democrats of cheating and of stealing the 2020 election. He called Democrats commies and Marxist, disparaged refugees from Afghanistan, advocated shutting down prosecutions of people who were arrested as part of that January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. There's more to the story, but George, you know, when the Tribune asked him, when I guess Brian asked him about calling Democrats commies, about, you know, communists, he doubled down and said, yeah, that's right. This is he suggested that some Democrats self-identify as communists. Maybe we can just start there with sort of the Red Scare aspect of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is another bit of another data point that establishes that Americans don't have a clue what a communist is. Don't know what the word Marxist means. There are people in the party like Bernie Sanders and AOC who might properly be described as democratic socialists who want higher taxes on the rich, more public services provided by the public instead of being placed at the mercy of the free market, like healthcare, for example. But calling any office holder in the United States, Democrat or Republican, a Marxist just shows that he doesn't know what the word means.
How about on election claims? I mean, just the idea that the election was stolen, it's something that's been hashed and rehashed over and over again. He made these statements on the social media platform Telegram, or on Telegram, which is a messaging app, I guess, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of a right-wing Twitter, I guess. Yeah. Brian Schott follows all this stuff, so that we don't have to. And for that, we owe him a lot. Thank you for doing that, because I don't want to go there. And it was interesting because since the primary and since he became the Republican candidate for Salt Lake County clerk, he has been saying things that have caused people to go, well, what's he talking about? Because he's been talking about election integrity, and he's been talking about whether mail-in votes or drop boxes are really secure and things like that, which kind of sound maybe like a little bit of a dog whistle to the Stop the Steal MAGA crowd. And you ask him about it then, and or he speaks up on his own and has written a couple of commentaries for the Tribune, where he'll say, no, I don't mean that. I just mean any government function needs to be overseen, needs to be questioned, needs to be audited. You know, things are perfectly reasonable things to say. Elections are important. There should be security. There should be safeguards. There should be audits. And so he says, that's all I'm saying. I'm not off there weird.
But then on social media, he says that the Democrats are cheating and that
right,
they stole the election.
And he did all this. I mean, he shut this down after the primary, apparently. And he shut it even further down when Brian Schott started asking him about it. But before the primary, it was the Democrats have stolen the election. Mike Lee hasn't done enough to overturn it. Mitt Romney certainly hasn't done enough to overturn it, the steal. Even Kevin McCarthy, one of the louder voices in the House, U.S. House Republicans, he said he hadn't done enough. He said that all the people arrested on the January 6th rioting should be released. That it was all there was nothing to it except a legitimate concern that the election had been stolen, and all these Telegram MAGA right wing things that have been completely discredited, that have no basis in fact. And you would think, I mean, the question is, does he really believe this stuff? Or is it the kind of thing you say to get noticed in the Republican Party? And then, I mean, it's traditional for as long as any of us have been alive. Republicans during the primary season run a little bit to the right. Democrats run a little bit to the left to get the nomination. And then between the nomination and the general election, they scamper to the center.
But is right or left conspiratorial? I mean, there's a difference between right and
no. There's a difference between the traditional Republican right, which is big on defense spending and lower taxes and pro-industrial and things like that, and this kind of Republican talking point, which is the Democrats are all crooked. They stole the election. January 6th was just a bunch of tourists expressing their First Amendment rights. And just total garbage.
He also says that the Democratic Party is full of, this is in Brian's reporting, Brian Schott, that is. We've got Brian Maffley here in studio, but Brian Schott's reporting. It says that the Democratic Party is, quote, full of mental cases, and that the Democrats were, quote, very involved with human and child trafficking, which is an old, not that old, but it's a conspiracy theory that goes back to, there's Pizzagate and the—
Right, all the QAnon stuff about how they're all— they're all trafficking and child pornography and trafficking and child prostitutes. But there's absolutely nothing there. But it stirs up the base. It gets people excited, and so apparently in some hopes that they, will vote for me, and then come the general election campaign, having secured the nomination, I don't have to talk about that stuff anymore. But, these social media trails are still there for people, something all of us should probably be aware of. When you say something, and people in my position particularly, but people who are running for office need to be aware of this. I mean, this stuff is not easily going away. It can be detected. And the fact that, you said it before and you said it on a channel aimed at this particular constituency, that doesn't mean it's going to stay there.
There's a couple of other points just from this reporting. After the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan, Margani claimed that Afghan refugees were being brought to the U.S. to increase the number of Democratic voters. And he also said that Governor Spencer Cox and Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson didn't object to the bringing of those refugees to the state of Utah because they are, quote, Democrat infiltrators.
It's really sad. I mean, Good is the child of immigrants from India. So you would think maybe he would have more sympathy to people who are immigrants to the United States, especially who have come here after all the mess in Afghanistan. And I don't know, if I were an Afghan refugee right now, I don't know that I'd be an easy vote for the Democrats when it was Joe Biden who pulled the American forces out of there. I mean, it was following up on a treaty that Donald Trump had made, but still. And so you'll have a lot of questions as to whether who's to blame for that and who's going to get your vote when you're here in America. Although, a lot of those Afghan refugees, at least in the short term, can't vote. They're not citizens yet.
Just on the going back to the conspiracy about the election being stolen and voter fraud, et cetera, there's been a lot of reporting, for quite some time about the fact that voter fraud is very rare in the United States of America. And then Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, who is the top elections official here in the state of Utah, said that there's no evidence of fraud in Utah elections, including the use of vote by mail, which was another place that this candidate was pointing to there being, a potential fraud. But she says that's one of the most secure ways we can administer it.
There's absolutely no evidence of any voter fraud, any systemic voter fraud, any widespread voter fraud. You're going to have a couple of things where, they even kind of came close to prosecuting this, where mothers of missionaries, Mormon missionaries who were overseas, would fill out the ballot, for their missionary son who was in Guatemala or someplace, and technically that's illegal, and the counties in the state have made that very clear, but what vote by mail is and what drop box voting is an attempt to get more people to vote. And that's all it is. And if you're and people who are against that, you have to wonder, they just don't want more people to vote. There are other Republican states where the state does not want more people to vote. They are turning these things around. They're taking back early voting. They're taking back mail ballots. They're taking back drop boxes. They're making it very suspicious as to what neighborhoods the drop boxes have been removed from. The Republicans who run Utah, to their credit, are not doing that. I mean, partly because they have every confidence that if they have a free and fair election and everybody votes, they'll win. So there's no incentive there.
I don't want to linger here forever. I guess one more point to sort of bring up. You mentioned the fact that there's this history of people running, you know, more to the right in a primary and then more to the left in a primary and so on and so forth. But then on the conspiratorial side of things, on stolen elections or on, you know, the pedophile rings or whatever it is that the QAnon conspiracy points to, some of that, I mean, the Red Scare stuff isn't new. I think of Joe McCarthy and the, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Yeah. But some of this is getting amplified more, I guess, is what I'm wondering. Like, maybe it's not new, but it definitely feels like we've jumped onto a different timeline.
Well, no. I mean, I remember seeing there used to be this newspaper called The Spotlight, which has nothing to do with the investigative team at the Boston Globe that we all saw a movie about. And it was John Birch's conspiracy theory. They're all communists. They're coming in the night. You know, I saw this when I was in high school, and so it's been around forever. But social media just amplifies it and makes it so much stronger. On Facebook, on Twitter, and then on these little side channels like Telegram that are oriented more to that audience and makes absolutely no pretense, unlike Facebook and Twitter, of going on and policing some of this stuff and taking down election misinformation and pandemic misinformation. That's their bread and butter, and it's covered by the First Amendment, and you there's only so much you can do about it, but it is damaging our democracy.
Okay. You know, I think that I'll just remind listeners that they're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. You can find Brian Schott's reporting on that story over at sltrib.com. And, you know, before we take a break, actually, let's turn to some other reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And let's bring in Blake Apgar, who is city and county reporter for the Tribune. And Blake, homelessness here in Salt Lake City is the topic of one of your stories. So the city is employing a strategy to try to prevent the growing of homeless encampments or from them growing in size and taking hold. The idea being that it wants to help people, but also it wants to help people before those camps get to be too big, unwieldy, and then they have to go in and tear them down. Can you just sort of tell us what this strategy is and or how it's being implemented?
Yeah, it's kind of a departure from the way that the city used to do this, which was spread outreach workers across the city, try and build connections. And, you know, with the limited staff, you can spread people thin quickly. And so what this is it's a new approach to target smaller camps. And the idea is you connect people who are living in these camps with services before the camps swell, and you have to bring the county health department in for, they call them abatements, but it's a clearing out of the camp. And that can be a really disruptive and traumatic experience for people who are living in large encampments. Large encampments themselves have a number of health risks. They're very disruptive to neighborhoods that they, you know, build up in. And so this is a way to try and prevent that from getting to that point.
And I guess, is it being successful? Since when has this been implemented? It's a new tactic. And do we have an idea of how successful it is in terms of, so it's this intervention team goes and what do? They go and offer, aren't people already offering sort of, you know, services to people who are out there on the streets?
Sure. It's, it's really trying to build trust with people who are living in encampments. And so, the city is going to try and connect them to like supportive housing services, perhaps substance use services, treatment services, and they've been, you know, they say they've been successful in those two realms. Where they've had a little more trouble is getting people connected with shorter term services, because people don't want to give up the stability of their situation to go into a shelter type scenario where they don't know where they're going to end up in a couple of days.
Meaning it's more stable for them to be in that encampment than it is to go to a shelter that might run out.
Certainly, yeah. It's just it's easier when you know where you're going to be for a little while. I think the problem that first I want to say that the city openly acknowledges that this is new. This came online at the beginning of June, and that they are still learning how to best implement this. And the issue that they face right now is there just aren't a whole lot of services. There's not a lot of housing options. There's not a lot of shelter space. And so, you can build a relationship with folks who are living in encampments, but it is it's hard to offer much when there's not a place to go.
And that's tough. So I guess the question that I have is, how successful has this been so far? To what extent is it getting people out of the camps and preventing them from growing in size?
Yeah, the city says that from the beginning of the program, so in early June to the end of August, they were able to help 10 people get off the streets. And, they admit that that's, I think a slow start. But where they say this is going to pay off is when more housing comes online. And we've seen an infusion of money from the state. It came from the American Rescue Plan Act. And so $55 million is being distributed through the state for housing services. Salt Lake City is putting in another $6 million for housing. And the city really wants those units to be available by the end of winter. And so people who are living in shelters will have a space to, a more stable space after winter shelters close. And so building these relationships now will pay off in the long run, because you'll be able to help people transition into those more stable situations.
It sounds like it's a nascent program, you said, since June, and having, I guess, some limited success. We don't have to linger here too much longer, I don't think, but maybe I'll bring in George Pyle George for a comment. A problem that is intractable and it seems, the solution seems eternally like more and more money and more wraparound services, et cetera, but an effort, I guess, by the city.
The services have to be there. And they've been talking for years about trying to, catch these things early. Ben McAdams, when he was a county mayor, used to talk about a one-stop shop and even try and help people who weren't homeless yet and who were going to have trouble making the rent, who were in danger of being evicted, and getting them some help and then getting them a federal voucher or some grant from somebody so for at least another month they wouldn't be homeless and you would face it there. And they wouldn't be on the street and they wouldn't be taking up shelter space. When they tore down the old road home, it had a reputation as being dirty and dangerous. And they said, well, we'll tear it down and we'll build these nice, shiny, new, clean service centers. And so people won't be afraid to go in them. And now we're hearing, it's cleaner and it's safer, but it's still hard to keep drugs out of these places. And it's still hard it hasn't been the rapid pass-through that they hoped it would be,
right?
Because the idea was you'll come in, you'll get cleaned up, we'll figure out, you're entitled to disability, federal disability payments. You know what? You're entitled to veterans benefits. Let's get you on that. And people who didn't even know that was available to them. So that's a huge help. But then they were supposed to flow on through that into permanent housing, supportive housing, temporary housing, something that would get them through the service centers. That's not happening because the temporary housing, the permanent supporting housing, isn't there. That's what the city's working on. That's what the Other Side Academy is working on with the tiny houses.
Yeah.
So people are working on it. And then in the camps, you have, a society that maybe is foreign to a lot of us, where people are saying, I'd rather live here. I know these people. They're in the same boat I am. They're sympathetic to what I'm going through. I trust them more than I trust anybody who runs a do-gooder homeless service. But it's not clean. There are drugs. There's prostitution. They're victimized by one another and by
outside,
criminals.
Outside forces, yeah.
Outside forces. So what the city's doing here, you know, trying to catch these things early, not waiting until an encampment becomes 50 tents, and trying to get them into services quicker. I mean, when you're talking about homelessness or physical or, you know, cancer or anything else, catching it early is always the best way to go.
Blake, I'll ask you a question that I ask. We're going to head to a break here in just a second, but that I feel obliged to ask, which is there anything from the story that we didn't touch on that you would have people know, about this effort by the city?
I think we went through.
Okay,
the whole
great.
Thing.
Yeah, just yeah. It's such a throwaway question. I apologize. apologize to the listeners as well. And we're going to take a quick break on the show. And when we come back, we will turn to some additional reporting on public lands by Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. Back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune City and County reporter Blake Apgar, public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley, and by editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling us up at 801-355-8255 or by tweeting to us. The handle is at KCPW. Brian Maffley, to your reporting now, and I want to start with your... It seemed like a scoop on this this Tabby Mountain deal, a big chunk of land that the state had been eyeing for a wildlife reserve and hunting area, by my understanding. There was a proposed sale of this chunk of land. That sale is now on hold, as I understand it. Can you actually situate us just geographically before we begin to explain the deal that didn't happen and why it didn't happen?
Yeah.
Where is this?
Well, Tabby Mountain is a really beautiful spot. You know, I don't think everybody knows where it is, so it's a mountain that's kind of above the town of Tabiona. Mm-hmm. It's named after a Ute tribal leader from the 1900s. And it's in the western part of Deschene County, right up against the Uinta Mountains. Part of it's in this land that's in question in Wasatch County. It's about 28,000 acres.
Wow.
That wound up in the hands of the Trust Lands Administration back in the 70s. Hmm. Today, yeah. It is now the subject of quite a big controversy between the state and the Ute Indian tribe.
Okay. And again, there was this proposed land sale. This is, I guess the question is, it was in the State Trust Lands Administration. This is CITLA. You can maybe remind us what that is. But then also, was it public land right now? If it's getting sold, are they selling off public lands? Or what is this? Yeah.
The question of whether CITLA land is public or not is a matter of contention in some circles.
Yeah.
So let's just back up to provide that context here. The CITLA stands for School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration. Fortunately, it has a handy acronym because no one can ever say that.
Yeah.
And it's an agency that was created in mid-90s sometime to kind of clean up the sloppy way Utah was managing its trust lands. And trust lands are kind of the opposite of public lands. They're managed for a very narrow purpose according to the state constitution. It's to raise money for schools. There's other public beneficiaries in there as well. And that's it. I mean, that has to be the guiding factor. You know, this idea of, you know, multiple use or the greatest good for the greatest number, like you hear with the Forest Service lands or the public trust. No, that's not the way CITLA manages its lands. It's to generate revenue, and no one gets a sweetheart deal.
Often generating revenue might mean leasing it for oil and gas.
Yeah.
It might mean,
It might mean putting a uranium mine on Cedar Mesa. Mm-hmm. And I'm serious, you know, and if that was what would make the trust the most amount of money, that's what they're kind of obligated to do.
Okay, so the CITLA, the State Institutional Trust Land,
School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration.
They were proposing to sell this big chunk of land, but it was kind of a secret sale. And they were going to be sold to the state is what it seems like was going to happen. But then the sale kind of got thwarted by another interested buyer. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
The State Department of Natural Resources has wanted to acquire Tabby Mountain for a very, very long time. And this last proposed sale was, you know, supposed to get the job done.
Can you tell us why they want to acquire it?
Yeah, DNR wants to get that land because it's basically undeveloped, beautiful alpine terrain that is important big game habitat.
Okay.
And it is a cherished place by the hunting community. And were the land to change hands, there's a fear that public access would be lost. So their number one issue was preserving public access to this land that potentially could be sold to a private buyer. And in this case, it turned out to be the most interested buyer was the tribe. Now, by design, CITLA's negotiated land sales are done kind of in secret. You know that, and so the lack of transparency has kind of contributed to this idea that the tribe may have gotten cheated here.
This is the Ute tribe.
Yeah.
And explain how that came to light, the idea that the tribe may have been cheated.
Yeah. So in 2018, this CITLA formally offered the land for sale and solicited bids. Eight parties expressed an interest. But the way this whole thing was structured made it very difficult for anyone other than the state of Utah to put in a bid. You had to put $1 million down up front, and you had only 30 days to do your due diligence. And it was, you know, it was January or whatever, December of 2019. It's really hard to go and take a look at this huge landscape to determine if you want to actually bid on it. So we don't even know who the other bidders were. In fact, it wasn't until a few weeks ago that we've learned that the tribe had submitted a bid. At the time the sale failed back in 2019, CITLA just announced that the process wasn't resulting in optimal bids, and they're going to suspend it. Well, here we are almost 4 years later, and they haven't resumed the sale. So what happened was, why we know about this now is the CITLA staff member who was responsible for, you know, putting the sale together back in 2019, his name's Tim Donaldson, was fired by the state in a different job in ways that he feels were inappropriate, and he has filed this whistleblower complaint with the state auditor. So he's asking John Dougal to investigate the Tabby sale and other issues around CITLA, where he seems to be suggesting that CITLA was trying to arrange some kind of sweetheart deal for the state to get the land at below market value. So what happened was when the CITLA puts this out to bid, the state puts in a bid that sort of matches the $41 million appraisal, which turned out to be a pretty badly flawed appraisal that the Division of Wildlife Resources had way too big a hand in determining. And
meaning it's probably worth more.
It's probably worth a lot more, than this $40 million. It's 28,000 acres. It's a huge chunk of land. Interestingly, the tribe already owns the minerals under the land. So if they wanted to have a, you know, mine for whatever minerals there, the tribe could do that. However, I don't believe there's much mineral potential there. So, you know, unbeknownst to everybody, the tribe put in a bid for $47 million. Now, publicly, CITLA revealed that another bid had come in, but never said from who or for how much. Well, the tribe came in with this bid for substantially more money. And so we published a story about this a week and a half ago. And the tribe declined to talk to us for the story. But then after the story ran, the tribal business committee chairman, Sean Chapuz, puts out this statement yesterday, which is now the subject of a story we posted this morning.
Okay.
And in it, Chapuz said, "It's bad enough that the tribe has to spend millions of dollars just to buy back its own land, but what really grates is the deceit and treachery with which the state has acted in order to block the sale from going through to the tribe as the highest bidder." So here's the next thing.
Yeah.
It was the state the highest bidder. CITLA says no, that they were the highest bidder after the first round of bidding. But CITLA contends that the state came back with a higher bid.
Meaning that the tribe started out at one, the state came back with higher. But now, but that doesn't mean anything because the whole thing is now on hold, right?
Yeah. Well, it means so CITLA says the state came back with a legitimate bid for $50 million. And at the request of the trust beneficiaries, they suspended the whole process. Tim Donaldson, in his complaint to Dougal, says, no, that $50 million bid was basically a pretext to put the whole thing on hold so the sale to the tribe wouldn't be able to go through.
And it just stays with CITLA.
This land stays with CITLA.
I want to ask, you said the DNR wanted to preserve access to hunting and to this section. What does the tribe say, the Ute tribe, say that they plan to do with this land?
They have not publicly said what they want to do. They have yet to talk to us about their interest in the land, although I have a feeling it has strong cultural significance to the tribe.
Right.
In Sean Chapusa's statement, he talked about how there was, that their reservation was established in 1861 at a few million acres. It was huge. It covered, the entire Uinta Basin up into the Uinta Mountains. And in 1902, the federal government, led at that time by Teddy Roosevelt, opened the reservation's quote-unquote surplus lands to settlement. And part of that was they took a million acres of the tribe's land and put it into what is now the Ashley National Forest. Mm. So in Sean Chapusa's statement, he talked about how unfair it was that in the 1970s, the Forest Service wound up transferring Tabby Mountain not to them, to the tribe, but to the Trust Lands Administration. This predated CITLA's creation. It's back in the 70s sometimes. And why CITLA even has this land is a mystery. I don't know why they would want it. It's not land you can easily monetize, and they don't have the minerals.
It's such a wild and Western story. I mean, as I think about the history and that... sort of rescinding of deals and taking away lands from the tribe, but also there's this question of access and the way. I mean, again, it's hard to untangle. We don't know what the tribe would do with it, but of course they have a that historic claim to the land that goes back far further than many of us.
Yeah,
yeah. But so what comes next? What happens now? Do we just wait?
Here's the thing. There's a lot of political pressure on CITLA these days. For years to manage the land in ways that make certain groups happy, especially ranchers and hunters. They seem like they expect preferential treatment. So when CITLA sells land, they often sell small holdings in public auctions. Well, when they sell that land, whoever had livestock grazing permit on that land loses it. And that's made some county commissioners, especially in Garfield County, really mad. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're seeing CITLA, which has done an amazing job raising money for the school trust. They're up to over $3 billion after 28 years in business. It truly is amazing. But that has come at a cost to the public in the form of losing control over landscapes like Tabby Mountain. Tabby Mountain is not to be managed for the benefit of the citizens of Utah. So that's just a fact. Mm. And so what I think is concerning to CITLA now is that if they do things like sell, that anger the legislature, like selling Tabby Mountain to the tribe or any other entity that would foreclose public access to that landscape, that the lawmakers would come back with some legislation altering their mandate and reining in their independence. And if that happens, well, they're not going to make as much money for the school trust.
I mean,
it's a mouthful. Yeah,
it is. No, it's a mouthful. It's just interesting because, is reining them in? Is that really? I mean, I guess that is that in the public interest? I wonder. If it's of its own accord. If the legislature were to do that?
I think members of the legislature would say, yeah, that would be the public interest. If the land's not being managed for the public interest, maybe we should tinker with their mission. The problem with that is that the Utah Constitution doesn't say anything about managing this land in the public interest or for public access. It's managed to raise revenue for schools. So I mean, so if the legislature alters the mission of CITLA or tinkers with it, well, they could be raising some constitutional issues.
Well, and then again, if it's sold to the tribe, it becomes the tribe's land. You said maybe forecloses public access, but of
course we don't know. We don't know what the tribe would do. But there was this assumption that under tribal control, it would no longer be open to the public.
Okay, George Pyle. I mean, this is a lot to untangle. I think it's fascinating, and again, it's a big chunk of land and a lot at stake for the future. But I don't know. There's no simple right answer here. What do you think about Brian's reporting?
Well, for one thing, it is very complicated, but I think you can kind of simplify it by going back to the old reliable, the Indians get screwed again. And that's often the bottom line with a lot of these things. And also, it's interesting because environmental activists and people like me have often looked at CITLA's mandate and said, well, there are things that are more important than raising a lot of money for schools. One of them might be environmental concerns. One of them might be, let's tell CITLA they can't sell land for uranium mines. They can't sell marginal land for oil and gas drilling because of the environmental impact that has. And, you know, maybe that's important to the next generation of school children, too, is that they can breathe the air at their school. And their mandate says, no, our mandate is we raise as much money as we can, whether it's leasing it, grazing rights, selling it, swapping it, whatever it is, we make as much money as we can. And so, you know, on the left, you say, well, there are more important things than that. Environmental concerns should matter. And then but then from the other side, you have, no, there are other concerns other than that. There are like hunting and grazing and drilling and other things that we want people to be able to do, and CITLA's in our way. So CITLA is kind of on this wall between the two sides. And anytime, you know, so for a long time, I've been saying, well, we ought to loosen their mandate a little bit and let them consider other things. But once you open that door, then you wind up saying, instead of what I want, which is CITLA saying, no, we're not going to lease this land for a uranium mine, even though that would make us a ton of money, because uranium mines are bad. Well, they're not allowed to make that value judgment right now. And they're also not allowed to make, supposedly, not allowed to make the value judgment that, you know, this land is of ancestral importance to the Ute tribe, and we ought to consider that in our decisions. Technically, they're not supposed to consider that either.
How will this get resolved, Brian? Or will it? Or, you know, what's the time frame?
Yeah, I've asked CITLA, are you going to get this, you know, resume the sale process? And they have no immediate plans to do that. I don't know what the resolution here is because, you know, the way CITLA is supposed to operate, you can't, you know, have a predetermined outcome for any of its proposed sales. But obviously the state of Utah wants a predetermined outcome with TABI, and that predetermined outcome is
DNR.
The state... DNR getting the land and having run it as a state forest. And Mike Styler, before he retired as DNR director a few years ago, laid out that vision. He sold the legislature on a $40 million appropriation to buy the land back in 2019. And that's when this whole thing fell apart. And when we interviewed Mike Styler at his retirement, I think when I asked him what his greatest regret was not getting the Dabby Mountain deal accomplished.
I guess you said there's that. Oh, there's so many questions that I have, and we could go on forever.
I
think we probably ought to head to a break. But the fact that there was that appropriation for this sale. But without thinking that there might be another big bidder in the form of the Ute tribe, did they just not anticipate that?
I don't think they did, and I think there was a lot of wishful thinking going on by having an appraisal that was done without looking at all the possibilities. Who were these other six bidders? Or rather, six parties who expressed an interest and didn't bid. I have a feeling some of them were either, you know, very wealthy individuals, or, you know, institution or corporations that wanted to privatize that landscape.
Right, and then do who knows what with it.
Yeah.
Well, Brian Maffley covers public lands and environment for the Salt Lake Tribune, and I really appreciate your reporting on this, Brian. I'm going to remind listeners that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with some more from this past week in Utah news.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Blake Apgar, Brian Maffley, and by George Pyle. And this is our Friday morning local news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. The handle is at KCPW, or you can call us up. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. Blake Apgar, I'm going to bring you back into the conversation from the city and county beat. You wrote about the fact that the Utah Transit Authority is cutting back services on a whole bunch of bus routes, or as many as 20 bus routes. Why is that happening?
It's one of those. So UTA is not unlike employers across the country, and it's facing a real staffing shortage. And so they have budgeted about 1,200 bus drivers. They're down 85 from that. And so they simply just like don't have the staffing power to keep the routes going right now. And so on December 11th, they're going to reduce or in some cases suspend service on 20 routes.
Staffing issues, 20. Do we know the 20 routes and what might this impact?
Yeah, they are. They're all listed out in the story, but it's going to affect routes that cover Salt Lake, Weber, and Davis counties. There's going to be some local routes that are affected, some regional routes, so like Ogden to Salt Lake, and then some of the ski service routes are also being reduced.
It's interesting, ski service routes, because I mean the one of the big stories that we've been following for quite a while is the Little Cottonwood Canyon story and what gets built there for transportation. One of the solutions there was increased bus routes, but it sounds like maybe ski routes are going to get decreased given this cutback. The pandemic probably didn't help for this in terms of labor issues, right? And, you know, retaining bus drivers.
Yeah. So, you know, UTA has seen a lot of resignations and a lot of retirements. They've had a lot of longtime employees, but I think some of that is fueled by fear of exposure to COVID, and a lot of it is just, you know, it's harder to bring people on now because job seekers can be a little bit pickier about where they go.
It's really interesting. I mean, I guess do you know the starting wage for a bus driver at UTA? Is that something that you can share with us?
Yeah. When they hire you on as a trainee, it's $20 an hour. After you get through training, it's like $21.50, almost $21.50.
It's not bad. I mean, but hard to retain people, I guess. And then there's the question of ridership and how that funds the agency itself, right? Is that an aspect of this? Is that not enough people are riding the buses?
That's not something I heard in my reporting on it. I mean, really, it's difficult to attract new bus drivers. UTA is looking at a couple of different ways to improve this situation. One of them is making schedules for new drivers more predictable and more attractive. When you're a new bus driver, you don't have the seniority in the bidding process to get, you know, attractive hours or routes. And so they're trying to improve that. They also want to bring in some more supervisors so that younger drivers have more support out in the field.
Okay. George Pyle, I don't know if you have any comments on transportation's woes.
Since the pandemic has eased, I've been on riding buses quite a bit. I love it, but I don't know that I would want to be a bus driver. It's hard work. Although one of them did tell me that one thing that I thought was helpful, you don't, as a driver, you don't necessarily drive the same route every day. You drive different routes, and I would think that would be more attractive because I think, you know, driving up and down 200 East all day, every day would get old really fast. And we talk about quiet quitting and people not coming back from the pandemic. And then you also have the problem of that UTA is going to be facing now. If you cut back routes, even if they're still running, but they instead of every 15 minutes, they run every hour or something like that, then there are going to be riders who are going to not ride the bus anymore. They're right. going to get out of the habit. They're going to buy a car. They're going to carpool. And then, say, they solve this problem and the buses come back,
there's no riders.
Will the riders come back? Yeah. You hope they will, but you don't know. I guess maybe we're going to have to start inventing self-driving buses. And I'm not sure I'm... You first.
Yeah, I'm not going to jump on that. But I guess I want to, from my perspective, I would love to have there just be, I want to see the opposite happen. I want to see more bus routes, and I would like it all to be free so that you can just jump on, jump off. It makes it more convenient. But I guess, we'll see what happens. Thank you for your reporting on this, Blake Apgar. With that, we're going to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Blake, I would be happy to give you the first bite at the apple if you want to give us a pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to characterize it as an underplayed story considering it was on the front page, but there was news this week that Kennecott is going to start mining underground after a century of digging into the ochres.
Yeah, after the open pit mine, now they're going to go underground, returning to their roots, sort of a story by Tony Semerad. Not Tony Semerad, was it? Tim Fitzpatrick. Thanks for that, Brian Maffley. And with that, I'll give you, you can find that at sltrip.com. Brian, I'll let you jump in with your pick.
You bet. I avoid talking about my own story. So I'm going to talk about Leah Larson's just amazing reporting on the Inland Port. She's got a few stories this week looking at the shaky economic foundations of what's being proposed for a transloading facility moving, freight from trucks to trains and vice versa. Really great reporting. It really kind of helps understand how that facility is supposed to work. I really recommend everybody read it.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to learn about what the plan is. Basically, you're training things from the coast to Salt Lake City, where they're getting unloaded in this transloading facility. They had the Stop the Polluting Port Coalition had a group an analyst from UC Berkeley, business professor, who said this doesn't pan out as a market proposition.
Well, this is what happens when you just listen to people who tell you what you want to hear. And I think that there's a little of that, and the Inland Port Authority is now under entirely new leadership, and they're reevaluating a lot of the things that they've had initially proposed.
A big pause at the Inland Port under new leadership. Great pick from Brian Maffley for Underplayed Story of the Week, Lee Larson's reporting. And George Pyle, your pick for a story that people may have missed.
Now, I was going to do the Kennecott Mine because that's the subject of the Sunday editorial that's coming up. And I'm not going to be as selfless as Brian. I'm going to plug myself.
Okay.
We spoke a little bit about the gondola when we were talking about bus routes and everything. The mayors of Salt Lake County, Alta, and Sandy came in to see the editorial board last week, saw the Tribune editorial board, saying, please don't build a gondola. It's a lot more expensive. It's a lot more disruptive of the watershed than electric buses. Well, maybe we've got to find somebody to drive electric buses. But, mayors don't always agree on things. I mean, they're fighting for the next box store and they're fighting for highway funding and everything. But, and the mayor of Salt Lake City sent her utilities director. So that's the subject of my midweek column this week about how the mayors really are against the gondola, spending all that money. And my proposal is that if the ski resorts really want to build a $500 million, which is going to be $1 billion gondola, they ought to pay for it. And the way they can find out if it's really a good idea is you float bonds, revenue bonds, and you say, okay, Wall Street investors, you pay for our gondola, we will repay you with revenue generated by the gondola and everything else involving the ski resorts, and see if Wall Street comes back and says, nah, I ain't buying that.
Well, you wonder about again, snow questions.
Is the ski industry, are these ski resorts even going to be viable in 30 years?
George, I just want to, we have actually a little bit of extra time, and I wanted to ask you if you can give us a little bit of a preview, if you were willing to do that, of your of the editorial board's column on Kennecott underground mining.
Well, yeah, I think this is like the good news, bad news story, is that we are electrifying the economy. Ford, GM, Volkswagen, Audi are all but all in on electric cars. That's great for the environment. That's great for global warming. But you need a lot more copper. You need some of these other rare earth elements that they mine here and other places. So even if you have a smaller carbon footprint, that doesn't mean you don't leave a mark. So as the demand for copper goes up, as the demand for other rare earth minerals goes up, that means there's going to be more mining. How damaging is that mining going to be? Does Salt Lake City want to be the sacrificial lamb to have its air dirtier so the rest of the world can have its air cleaner. If there's money in this, and there is, then it's time for the state and the feds to step up and say, yes, please mine this copper. We need this copper. But do it under these conditions with these emission regulations and these dust limits and things like that so that we aren't sacrificed here in the Salt Lake Valley to helping Los Angeles drive electric cars.
George Pyle, detangling a bunch of complicated things there. Thanks for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week and also for that preview of the Salt Lake Tribune editorial. For my part, I'm going to go with a report by Blake Apgar, who's here in studio with me, about the fact that a number of libraries around the country have been facing threats, meaning threats of violence, and have led to these FBI investigations. Some of it is kind of opaque because of the fact that we don't it's sort of still under investigation and they can't talk about it, but threats that have been made against libraries, and you got to love libraries, houses of books and knowledge. Thanks for your reporting on that, Blake. And I will just say, Brian Maffley, George Pyle, Blake Apgar, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, I really appreciate you joining me on Behind the Headlines today. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that does it for Behind the Headlines, which is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of this program over at kcpw.org or through your various podcast apps. Thanks for supporting this station and for supporting Utah Public Radio, which also airs us around the state as well. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.